angel appears at a faculty meeting at the university and turns to the dean. Dean, or an associate dean, or assistant dean anywhere, or vice president to the university perhaps, or president of the university, and turns to the dean and says, "In return for your unselfish and exemplary behavior, the Lord will reward you with your choice of infinite wealth, infinite wisdom, or infinite beauty. Take your pick." "Give me infinite wisdom," declares the dean without hesitation. "Done," says the angel, before disappearing in a cloud of smoke. All the heads in the room now turn to the dean, who sits surrounded by a faint halo of wise light. "Well," says the department head, "say something brilliant to us." And the dean stands up and, with the poise of Socrates, says, "I should have taken the money." I spent the entire week looking for a good joke to illustrate this story. It was hard to find one, friends, but that one kept on coming back to me again and again, because you have to be careful what you ask for in life, because you're probably going to get it one way or another. The religious leaders of the day, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the priests of the temple and the leaders of the synagogues, they were continually coming and questioning Jesus. They were continually coming and talking to Jesus. They were continuing gathering together and figuring out the kinds of questions they would ask Jesus, usually to try to trick him, usually try to give them something they could use against him. And that we have today, they come and they ask him, "What is the greatest commandment?" Because if he chooses one that is kind of minor, well, they could get him for that. If they chose one they disagree with, they could get him for that. In fact, you choose any one law, any one of the Ten Commandments, you leave the others open and yourself for criticism. So they figure, well, we'll just simply ask, "What is the greatest commandment?" And Jesus, of course, gives the classic answer, the one that we all know. But what most Christians don't realize is that he's actually seating himself directly within the very middle of the Hebraic faith, in the very center of the Hebrew faith, which we find in our first reading for today in Deuteronomy chapter 6, where we have the core of the Hebraic faith, the core of the Jewish confession of faith. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one." Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Which is the core of the Hebrew faith. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one." And then immediately after that, immediately after the firm affirmation of the Hebrew people, immediately after the core, their version of the Apostles' Creed, immediately after that core of profession of faith, he then continues with the reading, citing it. "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself." That's interesting, because he adds to it. He goes over Leviticus. He goes to the book of Leviticus, chapter 19, and he pulls another piece of the law. And he says, the second commandment is like it. Just as the love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Just as the first part is the core, the second part is essential too. He takes the core of the law. He says, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. He goes right to the core of the Hebrew faith. And then he goes over to Leviticus and he pulls for the second commandment. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. It's almost as if they can't be separated. Indeed, in Jesus' mind, it's clear they cannot be separated. If you have heard that the Lord your God, the Lord is one, then you will love the Lord your God. And if you love the Lord your God, then you will love your neighbor as yourself. Elsewhere, Jesus says, "This is my commandment, that you love one another. Now, if you were to go to General Conference or to go to other major bodies of Christian legislation, you would think that there would be other rules and regulations, other commandments of Jesus. This is my commandment, that you organize your church committees properly. This is my commandment, that you pay your apportionments. This is my commandment, that you obey the district superintendent. This is my commandment, and this is my commandment, and this is my commandment. But no, Jesus identifies at the core of the faith, this is my commandment, that you love one another. And we can only love one another when we love the Lord our God with all of our heart and soul and mind, with all the very essence of our strength. When we love the Lord our God, we can then love our neighbor as ourselves. He goes back to the core of faith, back to the heart of Hebrew faith, back to the very center of Hebrew existence, back to the affirmation that the Hebrew people proclaimed there in their affirmations of faith early on, before they had any other understanding of God, before they knew anything else about God. They knew, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one." They knew, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind." And they knew, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." And is this always true? It was true with them, and it's true with us as Christians. We get off course, we get off base when we start creating other rules and other regulations and treat them as if they're more important than this. The Jewish leadership had done that. They did it again and again and again. Now, it's true, it's important to understand the nature of the law. It's important to understand the nature of things like the Sabbath day and ritual purity and those other facets of the religious life. Those are important. But if you do so, if you lift those things up, if you focus on those other issues to the exclusion of, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one." If you do it to the exclusion of, "You shall love the Lord your God, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself." If you do it to the exclusion of the core of the faith, then the entire affirmation is meaningless. The Jewish leadership, the rabbis, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the priests of the temple, they were constantly trying to trap Jesus, to ask him questions and to entrap him with those questions. And again and again and again, we see he befuddles them. We see he outwits them. We see that he knows far more than they do. And he also demonstrates that while they know a great deal, and they do know a great deal about the law, they do know a great deal about God, they do know a great deal about faith, they do know a great deal about the religious life, they don't do it. He demonstrates that they are often hypocrites, liars, cheats, and thieves. He calls them whitewashed tombs, pretty on the outside, but full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness on the inside. He criticizes them severely. And here today, he demonstrates that while they know a great deal about God and God's love, they don't share that love with others. Notice the question he asks them: who is the Messiah? Who is the Messiah? And their answer is correct, by the way. He asks them, "What do you think of the Messiah? Who is the Messiah? How do you understand the Messiah? What is Messiahship?" Those are all possible ways to translate that phrase. And then he kind of leads them in the question. They should have ignored the second part. "And whose son is he?" And they said to him, "The son of David," which is a right answer. The son of David. But if just fill in the blank and "son of David" is the only answer you give, you've missed the point. Jesus' response is clear. "How is it then that David by the Spirit calls the Messiah Lord, saying, 'The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet. If David thus calls him Lord, how can he be his son? Well, that makes sense. One doesn't call one's son Lord. The Lord is a Lord, and an Adonai is superior to all else, certainly to a son. Jesus's point is clear. You may understand the proper definition of the Messiah as the son of David, but you've missed the point that he's also the son of God. You may understand that the Messiah is the anointed one of Israel, the anointed one of God, the one who's been called to lead the people away from unrighteousness, away from the missteps of the religious community, away from the occupation by the Romans and capitulation to them. You may have caught that right, but you've missed the point that the Messiah is also the Son of God. And of course, the implication is clear that he is the Messiah, and they've missed that too. Every time we focus in on the extraneous issues of the Christian faith, every time we focus in on the sideline issues, the fringe issues of the faith, we go astray too. If we put our focus on anything other than Jesus as Lord and the calling we have to love God and love neighbor as self, if we take our focus off of the core of our faith, we will do exactly what the Jewish leadership did. And the sad news is that that's what the church has done for 2,000 years, almost. The church is continually getting its focus on the wrong thing, the wrong things. Case in point, look at our fractured nature as Christians. Our denominations, Eastern Orthodoxy, Roman Catholicism, the first major split in the church 1,000 years after it began, was the split East and West, over one little thing. Whether or not you're going to say that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father, or the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. One word in Latin, filioque, split the church East and West for a millennium. And then, of course, we're celebrating the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, when Martin Luther nailed to a door his theses, 95 theses on how the church could be corrected. He didn't want to split the church. He didn't want to create Protestantism. He was protesting the errors of his community of faith. And in so protesting, and the response to that being such that they couldn't take it, they couldn't handle it, they couldn't back off and look at themselves with humility, they couldn't accept that there were reasons to be held to account and that there were issues that needed to be corrected, and the church ended up splitting again. Look at Methodism. Now, this is more of a political movement. When the Revolutionary War occurred, Methodism was a movement, a spiritual, social reform movement within the Church of England. And after the Revolutionary War was over with, the Church of England refused to send clergy back to the new country, to the United States. Even though there were 1 million Christians who were Anglicans in the colonies, now the new United States, the Church of England refused to send bishops, and the Church of England refused to send clergy. So John Wesley did it himself, and in so doing created the Methodist Episcopal Church, our predecessor denomination. Why? Over church politics, not theology, church and national politics. Look at splits that have gone down through the church, down through the centuries. Many of them are over unimportant issues. One word in a doctrine, one word in a confession of faith, one concept or idea could split a church. Or sometimes it was over issues like racism. The African Methodist Episcopal Church and its other sister denominations that broke off from the Methodist Episcopal Church did so over issues of racism. We have split again and again. And every time the church has split, every time the body of Christ has split, every time we have split, it has been because our focus has not been on love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself. If we were doing both, the chances of those splits would have been much less. We would have recognized that it's okay to have differences of opinion and ideas on theological matters that vary. And we would have realized that our sisters and brothers, regardless of ethnicity or national origin, are our sisters and brothers and should be treated the same. Every time the church has gotten off target, it's been because we have not loved the Lord our God and we have not loved our neighbor as ourselves. We may think we are, but we're not. And that's what's facing the church today. The United Methodist Church is moving quick towards another split. And it's because whilst we on both sides of this issue may think we love the Lord our God, unfortunately, our actions and our words reveal that we're not loving our neighbor as ourselves. We want to have it our way or the highway. There's only two ways of doing anything, the wrong way and my way. We want it our own way. Well, this is not the church of Burger King. This is a church of Jesus Christ. And Jesus calls us to love the Lord our God. Jesus calls us, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself." You know, sometimes we say, "Well, I love God." "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind." Not half of your heart, half of your soul, and half of your mind. Not this half here, but not that half there. "And you shall love your neighbor as yourself." "I love my neighbor, I just don't want him to be very close to me." No. As yourself. I don't care what your position is on what's facing the church today, the denomination, not this congregation, the denomination today. We're called to love the Lord our God and love our neighbor as ourself, and that means we don't run away from our neighbor. We don't divorce ourselves from our neighbor either. We stick with our neighbor. We may disagree with our neighbor, but that doesn't mean we're freed from loving our neighbor as ourselves. If we love the Lord our God with all of our heart, with all of our soul, with all of our mind, then we must love our neighbor. May we, as the people of God, divided though we may be by opinions and ideas, theological proclamations, social issues, divided socioeconomically, however we may be divided, may we love the Lord our God and love our neighbor as ourselves. And if that means taking a look again at what we believe and changing our mind, so be it. We still must love. As Jesus said, "This is my commandment, that you love one another." He said that to his disciples about each other. We must love. May we be a people who loves, who welcomes. I was talking with a friend of mine who is a Roman Catholic priest back in Archdiocese of Philadelphia, and he and I went to seminary together, and we were chatting not too long ago via email, exchanging things that were going on in our churches and also celebrating the meeting that was coming up that happened just last week between the Methodist group that and the Roman Catholic group that's looking at issues towards unity together. And he and I were exchanging some thoughts on the subject, and he said, "You know, Methodists are great. You love. You're a people of love, and you're known amongst other Christian groups as a people of love." And I said, "You need to come to General Conference someday." In fact, please don't come to General Conference someday. Please don't. And then I said, your community is wonderful. You have a continuity with your past, with your history. You know who you are and whose you are. And he said, "Don't come to diocesan meeting. You'll hear tons of ignorance amongst the clergy as to who we are and whose we are." Well, my friends, we are called to be a people of love. We are called to be a people of love who are called to love the Lord our God with all our heart, all our soul, all our mind, and love our neighbor as ourself. This is the first and second commandment. The greatest commandment, and the other one, the second one, is just like it, Jesus says. Depends upon it. It's impossible without it. And if you're not doing the second one, you're not really doing the first one either. May we not fall into the same trap as the religious leaders of his day. May we not fall into the same trap as the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the priests and the Levites of Jesus' day, who could answer the questions and get the answers essentially right, but misunderstand them and misapply them, and not apply them. May we learn the lesson and love the Lord our God and love our neighbor as ourselves. In the name of the Father and of the Son.
Been listening to a sermon by Dr. Gregory Neal, Senior Pastor of the First United Methodist Church in Commerce, Texas, and Rector of Grace Incarnate Ministries. Copyright 2017 by Dr. Gregory S. Neal, all rights reserved. For more information and for other sermons by Dr. Neal, visit us on the web at www.revneal.org. That's www.revneal.org. You are also invited to visit us in person at First United Methodist Church, 1709 Highway 24, Commerce, Texas, 75428. This program was produced by Dr. Greg Neal.